Leon. Okay. All right, my name is Andreas Droulias. This is Thursday, 6th of May 2004, and I'm here with Michael Krauss to speak about his work on the IAC language. Can you say that again?
Have you tested my voice and the microphone, and is it working just fine now?
Okay, we are back again. All right.
Yeah, and I've forgotten, you're not interviewing me now, but rather you hope that I will say something about IAC and my work on IAC.
I'm listening, yes. I'm not interviewing, actually.
Well, okay, but please do interrupt or interview me as questions may arise.
Okay.
As I don't trust either my intelligibility or given my present circumstances, my intelligence either on this. For me, IAC has been a major, central and crucial concern because of the nature of the language linguistically and genetically, and because of its position socially as the most endangered language in Alaska, now with one remaining native speaker, and as such, the closest to extinction. But first, an explanation of why I'm particularly concerned about that in connection with what I, insofar as I can remember, what I've already said about my history and personal nature. Which makes this centrality of IAC so inevitable and obvious. For one thing, because of its very state of endangerment, actually there were six people still alive when I first came to Alaska, seven, who knew a lot, or at least a bit, of IAC as native speakers, but it was already then obviously also by far the most endangered and powerless and unrecognized, in a sense, of Alaska's native languages, hence the importance of that to me, given my priorities and instincts of concern for endangered underdog languages. Not that IAC had been totally undocumented, actually far from the case. But still, it was obviously the most in need of work, both in terms of the race against time and the relative importance of the language. Can we interrupt the tape for a second?
All right. We're back.
So that said, the reason is obvious, and I'll make it more obvious now, talking about the genealogy of IAC. IAC is, even before I had chosen to do IAC, I should explain that the First time I had a grant and time, none of this was ever supported by the university. I was the summer after my first year of teaching French here and linguistics, was in the summer of 1961, and that was largely devoted to two things. One, general survey of the state of Alaskan languages. The state of EAC was obvious amongst those. And number two, working with Athabascan, as I hope I did describe in the other tapes, starting with Minto, Ninana, Tanana, Athabascan, in that first summer of my own work.
Well, you haven't actually, you have told me that you've done work in Athabascan, but you haven't actually gotten into that.
It's what I did with Athabascan, yeah. Well, I fancy that that summer, that first summer, I actually did two things. I had got a grant from NSF, which is the hero in this thing, not the University of Alaska. And this was for surveying and the general work on Alaska Native languages. That first summer, EAC was certainly one of the top priorities, and that work went to Robert Austerlitz. Austerlitz, a major and well-established linguist at the university, at Columbia University in New York, and I a trivial stipend of $50 a week and expenses. He worked for 6 weeks with EAC. And it confirmed its nature and importance, but was not able himself to continue beyond that 6 weeks of field work in 1961, during which I spent the summer doing the work in Minto, Ninana, Athabascan, which was very fundamental and I think made a major contribution to the understanding of Athabascan languages, and particularly the historical phonology and relationships amongst them, and of those in turn, as a single family of 30-some languages, to EAC, which was the second branch of the same family. So EAC was, became obvious, was confirmed, was a coordinate branch with its then six, one might say, speakers to the entire family of Athabascan languages from Alaska, stretching from Alaska down to Apachean, with 30-some languages. So it was extremely obvious that its genetic position was crucial from a scientific point of view, and aside from the social point of view, which no one really to this day understands the importance of. That's a whole other monstrous subject. But purely scientific from the point of view of historical linguistics, EAC was confirmed as being coordinate to all of Athabascan with over 100,000 speakers of 30-odd languages. And it's since Austerlitz was not in a position to continue that the following year, it became obvious that I should. I conferred with Austerlitz in the summer, as I did with the other four, I think it was, people that I had working on that grant in the field in Cordova that first summer, and met two of the EX speakers that he did most of his work with, and was familiar with the nature and importance of language, and determined during that second year that I was, that my first priority was going to have to be to take over the EAC project myself.
Who were the other people working with you?
There were two worthless grad students from the University of Washington, both working on Athabascan languages, both south of the range, Tenaina at Mount Dalton and Atna at Copper Center, for which the results are zero, and Irene Reed and Martha Tilak, then students here, who did heroic work with Central Yupik and the Yupik, or so-called Aleut, of Chugach, Prince William Sound. And they, together with Austerlitz and myself, constituted the first group of people working on Alaskan languages under my NSF grant.
So, had Austerlitz worked on EAC before you?
Well, he worked, yes, that first summer, but of course had not worked with EAC before that.
Okay.
There are, work on EAC has its own history, which I could go into. But the which deserves to be recounted, but the nature and importance of EAC in its historical position is such that we figure that for 3,000, maybe 3,500 years, EAC had an isolated, independent development, all its own, branching off in a different direction linguistically from Athabascan and from its congener or relative proto-Athabascan, that split, as it were, is as though it, the difference is such that it is as though EAC had been isolated from Athabascan in its development for 3,000 to 3,500 years of separate historical development. And where exactly it was historically, or prehistorically rather, is extremely difficult to understand where there was room for it to be so isolated and develop that way for so long. But once we know of it historically, it is a not maritime but land-based shore oriented language, culture, instead of chasing marine mammals, like especially whales, out of the question, big time uh, delicacy and prize for EAC hunting was mountain goats upland from where they are known to have lived on the shores of Alaska from Yakutat area north to almost to the Copper River Delta, not quite Prince William Sound or Cordova itself, which was still Aleutic, or so-called Aleut Chugach Eskimo territory. And historically, or proto-historically, if that's the word, recent prehistory, it makes it quite obvious that EAC was moved or chased northwestward within that Yakutat to Cordova area by assimilation to, rather than extermination by, Tlingit's culture. And it's clear that in the 18th century, say around 1800, there was still EAC some at Yakutat, but it was heavily invaded and dominated by Tlingit expanding northwestward. And the EAC language probably became extinct toward the middle, or maybe earlier, the 18th century in Yakutat, 19th century, sorry, in Yakutat. But by, say, 1900, the end of the 19th century, there were still a few old people at the Yakutaga Kaliak River area that still remembered EAC, and in living memory in the late of the 70s, there were still a few old people originally from Yakutaga Kaliak who could remember, not any EAC themselves really, but they could remember that the elders in their youth were bilingual and could speak EAC as well as Tlingit, say, in the 1890s. Further up at Controller Bay, there was EAC still, but Tlingit was becoming dominant. And by about 1912, it was probably no longer regularly spoken, but there was one man still alive, Mike Seawalk, then in his 80s in 1960, who could remember some EAC. So I heard with my own ears, Controller Bay EAC, which was then almost completely extinct by 1900, by 1960. The next group, Copper River Delta, Alleghenic and EAC. Alleghenic was destroyed or lost by the turn of the century, but some of the people, they were essentially the same group as those at EAC Village on the far side of EAC Lake from Cordova, at the throat of the lake there. The word Igyak, Igyak, IGYA'Q, or Igyarak in other Yupik languages, means gullet, throat, and it's a very common Yupik name for villages at the outlet of a lake, such, for example, as Igigik and Iliamna, and Igigik in the Bristol Bay area, which are the same Igiak, which is typical and pointed evidence that the place names and the inhabitants of that area that Iyak now takes its name from were in fact Alutiiq Yupiks until the probably certainly 18th or 19th century, and that the Iyaks took over a bit of that territory, Copper River Delta, Iyak Lake area, and ironically are known by what originally was an Aleut name, Iyak, which becomes Iyak in Iyak. Was a bit of a, as they were losing territory to the southeast, they gained that little bit of territory in the northwest and are known for their last stand there. In the late 19th century, we have reports that the Tlingit was very well known to many of the people in the Alleghanic Iyak area. But they continued, this was the only place left now where Iyak was still the dominant language. And the last speakers of Iyak, for example, Lena Naktan, remembers that her father could speak Tlingit, but she and her generation of the 20th century could not because these last Iyaks, in their last stand in what had hitherto been Aleut territory, and the Tlingits and the Aleuts were battling each other, with Iyak being a trivial buffer, not even a buffer, in between, a non-entity in between, Iyak was a probably a language which would have died faster, was already doomed to assimilation to and replacement by Tlingit language, and the truncation of that process by the establishment of the white American canneries in the 1890s are what stopped that conflict, and with the Aleuts from the Tlingits, and stopped at the last moment the complete assimilation of Iyak into Tlingit. It's a terrible irony, actually, that what ended up wiping out the Iyaks actually preserved it for an extra generation. It would have been lost even sooner. So that Iyak is an example of an Alaska Native language which was going to disappear due to the expansion of other Native languages. Let's remember that, you know, Tlingit and Iyak were a few hundred, like maybe in the end there, 1900 or 1880s before the canneries, still maybe 200, 250 people, probably never exceeded 500 in the area that they're known to have inhabited, compared to these huge maritime sea mammal hunting cultures like Tlingit and their huge wooden dugouts, and the Aleutiiq and their huge skin boats. two vastly different cultures converging over what was left of this tiny fragment of Iyak. And so there's a certain lesson there, which probably no whites in Alaska understand, but which Annie Nelson Harry, Dean Swift-like, the Irishman, understood fully. And there's even an Iyak expression that your turn will come too. So lest the Tlinkits get too big for their britches at Yakutat, for example, there's yet another bigger fish swallowing them up. Mm-hmm. Just as Iyak at the bottom of the feeding, what do you call that, sequence? What do you call that?
Feeding chain?
Huh?
Feeding chain, the cycle, feeding cycle.
There's a word for it, at the bottom of the feeding something. chain, so to speak.
Yeah.
Tlinkits for a while there thought they were the top. Little do they understand what's in store for them, which I'm sure is now obvious, but Annie was the prophet and the person with the swift-like perspective, just as it's impossible to imagine Gulliver's Travels written by an Englishman or a Frenchman, the arrogance of which would certainly preclude any such insight. Irish, had to be an Irishman, could not, never have been. A Tlinkit or an Aleut, understanding that. Those first two stories in that book, which are the virtual equivalent of Gulliver in Lilliput and Gulliver in Brobdingnag, and have all that same insight that I can't begin to tell you, but that's fine because Annie does it so beautifully in that book. That's sort of a thumbnail sketch of Iyak history in its last stage. What Iyak might have been prehistorically conceivable, that Iyak was the language all the way down to who knows where Tlinkit left off before it expanded northwestward. There's no way to know, the contact between Iyak and Tlinkit is not probably very ancient. The main relationship are loan words that are relatively recent, and I don't think there's much sign that Iyak was in contact with Tlinkit for 1,000 years or something, but for a few hundred, it certainly was. Where it was all this time, isolated from inland Athabascan, is can be answered not by me and by ultimately, who knows. It's one of those mysteries. That's sort of enough on that. Now for the history of the study of Iyak, before me and then by me. first Iyak words ever transcribed were naturally by the Cook expedition in 1778 and Prince William Sound. The vocabulary taken by the ship's surgeon, William Anderson, includes a few phrases that are, although supposedly Aleutian, are almost certainly Iyak. And there are a few more Iyak words in the Strange and Walker vocabularies from Prince William Sound in the 1780s, 1786. And a few Iyak words, generic place names, supposedly creek names or river names, in the Tachanov manuscript, never published, of a Russian who made a trip on foot from Yakutat to Copper River Delta in the company of Iyak speakers. And 1794, a census including some names that include some of Iyak origin at of the people on Kaliak River by the Russians Kulikanov and Kulikalov and Portov. So there was already a little bit of never identified, but Iyak language Iyak language documentation, never, just incidental and accidental, in the 18th century, of which we never would have been able to make any sense of. But on Shelikhov's 1796 map, which gives the main groups of Alaska Native peoples, according more than anything else by their language, Iyak, then known as Ungalaqmiut, or which is the Aleut word for them, or for the people living to the left as you face the sea, in this case to their east, southeast. That name in the form of Ugalachmut or Ugalachmut was clearly shown in its own designated area, which closely corresponds to the area on my map, from 1796. Iyaks were known as one of the native groups, as a separate group. And 1805, accordingly, the extraordinary set of vocabularies taken together by Rizanov, probably all during his stay in Sitka with representatives of these different groups. Hold the line. Hold it for a second. Yes. Yeah, Rizanov made, probably by working simultaneously with speakers of six languages, over 1,000 words in each of these languages in six columns, manuscripts which, thank God, we have. I managed to extract from the Soviet Union, Bergsland managed in 1954 to extract from the Soviet Union first, was, not extract, but get a copy of microfilm, contained 1,000 and some words of, among the other languages, Aleutic from both Kodiak and Prince William Sound, Tanina, Tlingit, Aleutian Aleut and Eyak, recognizing it as it had been since at least 1796, as one of the major Alaskan language divisions, rather cleverly done considering the limitations of the Russian alphabet strictly. Very important document, probably from the Yakutat end, showing that Yak is pretty much a single dialect, even to not have any deep dialectal differences, at least then left by 1805. So it confirms a lot, and we've been able to, with a great deal of effort, re-elicit or identify 97% or so, or 95% of the material in that, and gives us a good historical background on Eyak from virtually the time when these languages were first contacted. And subsequent to that, more recently discovered in, by a 1990 trip that I made to Soviet archives in Leningrad, three hitherto unknown but lesser vocabularies of Eyak, one from Yakutat showing greatly increased Tlingit influence. Two more that were published, although not properly identified, during Russian times or from Russian times, so that deliberate one to Rezanov, the three recently discovered ones, the four, Wrangel. Circa 1835, published 1839 in Russian, six and or five, and then six, one published by Gibbs from Furuyama's, from a missionary, Orthodox missionary working with Furuyama. Under Furuyama in the 1860s, so that there were half a dozen, oh, not counting Rezanov, which makes it seven, six others besides Rezanov, vocabularies done in the Russian period, and which would recognized or recognizable as the as Eyak or Ugalakhmut, Unalakhmut in the Russian literature. When the Americans took over, all of this information was lost, basically published. And even to Boaz, even though it's very clearly, the identity of the Eyak language is very clearly discussed by Alvin Krause in his book about the Tlingits, which was published in German. In 1885, that Boaz somehow or other must have been asleep when he inevitably saw it, because Boaz, who was a champion of rescuing documentation of languages that were about to disappear, never said anything about Eyak or seemed to be the least bit aware of it. Otherwise, he would have, no doubt, seen to it that somebody did something. So it was left to, essentially, to Frederica de Laguna on her Danish-American expedition, first one, 1930, where they were in Cordova outfitting for archaeological field trip to the Prince William Sound, Incidentally heard from a local game warden there that these local Indians had their own lingo, and it was different from Tlingit, and it was different from Mountain, and it was different from Aleut, so-called Aleut. She made a note of that, but it was not until 1933, the next expedition, follow up with herself and Danish anthropologist Kai Birgit Smith and Norman Reynolds, a graduate student then at the University of Washington. That did any work with EAC language or culture, language and culture, and published the famous, deservedly famous book, EAC Indians of Copper River Delta, which came out in Copenhagen in 1938 in English, which at the end has an 800 or so word vocabulary. Still in less primitive phonetics than before, and from which there's no mistaking as to what the nature of the EAC language is genetically with regards to Athabascan, which they themselves recognized. No, they didn't, but they certainly did its importance. And its importance enough to spend what nobody otherwise understands either, because it looks like a substantial book. All the paper is kind of thick, print is kind of big, the margins are kind of big, but it looks like a substantial book, the be-all and end-all of EAC ethnography, if not linguistics. It ended up being that, basically. Because by the time they got there, there were only 38 EACs left in Cordova. And they weren't aware of any much elsewhere. That was the base, that book was done heroically on the basis of no more than 17 days of contact. With most definitely, centrally, Galushia Nelson, a man already quite ill, who had been sent out to from Alleghenic to Chamawa Indian boarding school in Oregon. And therefore deculturated and so on for 10, 15 years, I forgot it. It gives that information in the introduction there. He was an exceptional guy. He made it back, unlike many others who were taken away to boarding school outside from EAC area. He actually made it back, but found his people in such a distressed situation, given his health and the context there, he committed suicide, tried to commit suicide. There was we even have a little newspaper blurb from somewhere, I forgot, which jeeringly points out that that Indians aren't even capable of succeeding in killing themselves. There's a certain amount of terrible tragedy that he, I think, contracted the last EAC to EAC marriage with Annie Nelson, then more or less an orphan, who was at the time was 12, I think, in 1918, and that was the very end of EAC culture, but Galicia was very exceptional in taking a kind of academic historical interests in given his love of his people and loyalty to them, and the presence of his young wife, who is also a very extraordinary woman, as we can see from the much later tellings of the stories in both 1933 in English and then again in 1960s in IAC, to me. Yeah, she was the main supplier of the stories, or the interpreter, so to speak. She was the main supplier in Galicia. Her husband was nothing but the interpreter. That book is the major, was back then, until recently, the major source of information on IAC. Much later, Freddy de Laguna in the 80s, in the volume of the Handbook of American Indian, North American Indians, HNAI, for the Northwest, writes a much updated version, which includes a lot of what she learned from her work in Yakutat, subsequently about which she wrote a huge three-volume masterpiece. At the Smithsonian, and the Smithsonian Handbook contains her updated chapter on IAC, which is extremely valuable, both from its as a basic introduction to IAC and as a updating, especially of the perspective of IAC as having earlier been present as far south as Yakutat, at least, the irony of their ending up being called IAC after the Chugach name of the last village which they were discovered and hence got their name is part of the typical irony. Okay, it's part of the typical irony in the tragic history of Native North America. IAC being, incidentally, one of the very last tribes, quote, to be discovered, by which time they were already verging on extinction. The Laguna documentation of IAC, with some contribution by Norman Reynolds as well, is the first meaningful American documentation of the language, as well as practically the only ethnographic work ever done for the people. De Laguna duly sent copies of the vocabulary in typescript to Edward Sapir, top American linguist of this time, who had worked very extensively with Athabascan, and he recognized the position and importance of IAC and was involved in efforts to get a follow-up expedition to work on the language, including, for example, Mary Haas, a top American student of Sapir's. It was a depression, and Mary was told that Cordova is not a fit place for a single woman, paternalistically enough, but also Cordova was not a fit place for much else either. And ends up having the responsibility for the final extermination of EAC, really. It was the canneries and the terrible conditions, economic destruction of EAC food supply, and social destruction of the people, exploitation with by the Chinese workers who were supplied with opium in the canneries, and the American workers who were supplied with whiskey, provided everything destructive, but no work for the EACs. Took away their food and their social well-being, and I don't suppose it ever occurred to them to wonder why each season when they came back there were fewer and fewer EACs. But in living memory, let's say by 1905 or thereabouts, when Annie was born, people could remember maybe there were 50 EACs. By 1938, 33, there were 30 some, and by 1960 there were, in terms of speakers, seven, and I should name them all. Minnie Stevens Gruka, who, wife, now widow of Skar Ach Stevens, mother of the last two speakers of the language, Sophie Borodkin and Marie Smith Jones, who the last, the latter of whom is still alive, and now the only EAC speaker. She died in March of 1961 before anybody got there. But I left out two very important subsequent people working on EX since 1933. 1940, John Peabody Harrington, very difficult and notorious character, and no doubt a transcriber of the last gasps of more languages in North America, from the Smithsonian Institution, was in Yakutat and got bilingual responses from George Johnson, then of Yakutat, originally of Alleghenic, Catala area, in Yakutat, in both Eyak and Tlingit, to the tune of about 400 words, I would guess, in his voluminous notes, which are pitifully little value in certain ways. He was a good phonetician, but the brain attached to the ear, is, one may wonder. And that is not a major contribution to documentation of EAC in some ways, but everything counts, and I certainly took great pains to get copies of all of this material, of course, insofar as I was able. And then in 1952, Li Fangkui, a superb linguist, was sent by the Linguistic Society people to work in with EAC, and he worked with Skar Stevens and Minnie Stevens in particular in 1952, and in Yakutat with George Johnson especially. And got several notebooks full of rather valuable documentation, relatively well transcribed. The first, well, no, Harrington's is well transcribed too, but the first really voluminous or significant corpus. But still not enough to do, get the grammar or a vocabulary of, I mean, an extensive vocabulary of the language. We surely know quite well how much we had missed from, had we stopped at 1952. And the Fongria was most generous with me in allowing Xeroxes of his field notes as well, as was then Austerlitz in 1961. So I had extensive discussions and copies of all of their field notes. So that's quite an American dynasty then too, Frederick de Laguna, John Peabody Harrington, Lee Fongria, and Robert Austerlitz, having worked with the language before me, but none of them really protractedly or extensively, but each with one field trip of a few weeks. The last two being especially important, Austerlitz got, of course, not anymore with the oldest generation, which died out with Minnie Stevens in 1961, the spring before the summer Austerlitz got there, but with three major modern speakers, or actually four. He worked a bit with George Johnson, got a text from him, and worked not that extensively with Annie Nelson Harry, but most of all with Marie Smith Jones and Lena Nactan Saska in Cordova that summer, for about 6 weeks. Lena Nactan Saska, or Lena Saska Nactan, was divorced from the Aleut Ponti Nactan and hadn't spoken Iyak too much during her marriage to her, but after her divorce from him and moving back to Cordova, she spent a lot of time with Minnie talking Iyak and quotes brushed up or very much revived her EX, so that in some ways she became both grammatically and lexically the most important single source. Marie and her sister Sophie were then the youngest speakers. Sophie was in no condition in the 60s to work with. Marie, not much better either, but she has survived the longest and out and survived even, as she would proudly and very justifiably say, survived her alcoholism too. There's a lot to be thankful for there now. But at the time, Lena Nactan in one way and Annie Nelson Harry in another way were the crucial contributors to the documentation of their own language. Incidental on the side, or less important, were Mike Suwak, then 80-ish, 80-something, mostly blind and mostly deaf, living in the Cordova Hospital from Catala, or the Bering River region. Gee, did I forget that? Yeah, I left that out. Bering River in Controller Bay was between Kaliak and, oh, I think I did mention it, and the Allegheny-Kiak Cuff River Delta area was such that at the turn of the century, although Eyak was dominant, I think it was dominant, still Mike Suwak in 1960, I did mention, could remember some words of Eyak, including one pathetically, when I would ask him something, he said this phrase, silat stitat, and I never heard that last word, stitat. I took it to Lena, and she said, oh yeah, I remember that word. It means my tongue is stuck. In other words, in protesting to me that he was tongue-tied for Eyak, he came up with a word that I otherwise never would have gotten, and for which is an interesting Athabascan cognate. Such are the ironies of these things. So Suwak had some conservative Tlingit-induced conservatisms in his Eyak pronunciation, and so what we have from him is important, if only a few hundred words. And George Johnson, again, a few hundred words from him at the Yakutat, and also from Sophie Barodkin Marie's older sister, who died in the early 80s, but with whom I did work in the early 80s and later 70s, somewhat more extensively, who knew aspects of Eyak that others didn't, and who was by that time also had survived her alcoholism, and was a fine person to work with by then. So I did work with everyone left who had any memory of Eyak language in my time, and those are six people again. In terms of their importance, Lena Naktan, Lena Saska Naktan, Annie Nelson Harry, Marie Smith Jones, George Johnson, Sophie Barodkin, and Mike Seawalk, in something like reverse chronological age. That is six different people, plus six Russian sources for late 18th century very incidental sources. Seven Russian 19th century vocabularies, and Freddy de Laguna and Norman Reynolds, John Peabody Harrington, Lee Fong Kwe, an American known as Fong Kwe Lee, and Robert Austerlitz before myself, which is quite a history. I stopped counting, but that's a significant number of sources.
But you did say there were seven native speakers?
Yes, the seventh died months before Austerlitz got to Cordova in 1961. Okay. But I would say that in a certain sense, for practical purposes, shall we say, the last person, the last EEC, spontaneous EEC, normal, regular conversations took place between Minnie Stevens and Lena Nactan, and Minnie Stevens and her two daughters, especially Marie. Sophie was older, grown, and married away. But there had been no regular conversations held in EEC until the past 1961. Everything else was memory. And I did not get, given those circumstances and the fact that I could only get away for short periods of time in summers and a few other things, as university duties never included any support for, or even tolerance for EEC, unless I had my own money and was not being paid by the university.
How come then the National Science Foundation gave this grant?
I mean, National Science Foundation, thank you for asking that question, is a hero in my book, not just because it supported me, but because it never lost track, even during the days of the Chomsky thrills and the ascendance to almost exclusive priority and prestige within linguistics to theoretical concerns a la Chomsky, that the fact that Native American languages are dying left and right, and that documentation of such languages was not even considered worthy of linguistics, to be called linguistics, but merely maybe some kind of drudgery or indescribably humble, worthless activity. NSF never lost track of this, of the importance of this, and it always supported the documentation of Native American languages, or of any languages, but especially Native American languages. So it was relatively easy, shall we say, for me to get support from them. The university is a whole different story. But with regard to NSF, I have to say this, that I remember in probably 1963 writing a proposal to them including the statement that there are very few speakers left, only five or something, and the youngest of whom, referring to Marie, is already quite elderly. And I wrote this when I was still in my 20s, and Marie, already quite elderly, was in her 40s.
Okay.
But she looked that way to me. It was sincere, and she was had terrible hacking cough from constant smoking all the time. I had no idea whether she'd be alive the next summer or not. And she was distinctly the youngest. But she's, hell, I mean, I say this with some amusement, and it goes even, it's even worse than that. With my latest health problems, life-threatening illness, and hospitalization, Marie, still there, is the one calling me concerned about my health and survival. Here she is already quite elderly, and I was worried about her survival 40-some years ago. And now she's worried about mine. She's still there and worried about mine. God bless her.
So, because I mean, this going back to National Science Foundation, were there any? You said they were following, they didn't lose track, but were there any like particular individuals that were interested?
No, it was a general linguistics program policy to take sensible priority for what was going on. In the 80s, I was on their panel for evaluation of linguistic proposals, and at that time there were 6 members of the panel. And my narrow specialty, the others were, you know, neurolinguistics and sociolinguistics, blah, blah, and theoretical linguistics, and so on. And there was, I was the only one on the panel with responsibility for descriptive, documentary, and historical linguistics.
Right.
1 out of 6. But I was heated even during those days, or at least they saw fit to include me in their top evaluation panel. And it was a hell of a lot of work, but they had never lost track of what had become so unfashionable in linguistics as this mere documentation of endangered languages. And so they must be given due credit for their heroic and exceptional stand in this regard. And that's what kept things going, especially during the 1960s, before the state of Alaska stepped in and entrusted the university with funds to do this work instead. But during the 60s, it came exclusively from National Science Foundation and somewhat from the National Endowment for Humanities as well, but never from the university. And the university's only siphoned off what the state gave it. Excuse my repeated emphasis on this very negative matter. Again, sort of privately, there was an article, and the subject is becoming very fashionable now, in part also because some of the things that I called attention to in the early 90s. And there was an article, as often happens nowadays, on endangered languages, specifically about what's now called Kahuescar, it used to be Alakaluf, one of the Patagonian languages about to become extinct in Chile. And there are a group of Chileans who are working to do what they can for Kahuescar. But it's mainly about that. And it's called, that activity is called language reclamation. And it does add, incidentally, that in North America, there are only 3 universities in North America that do this kind of work: MIT, University of Arizona, and University of Alaska. Well, that's in spite of the University of Alaska. At MIT, it was because of Ken Hale exclusively, and he's dead now, so you can guess how much MIT is doing. And on top of that, I am assured by someone at the University of Arizona that this activity has completely ceased there, too. So as a comforting finale or consistency to who gets credit for this kind of work, as is typical of the media, news media, and
they don't recognize
the facts or accuracy of things. So, given my feelings about that, I keep returning to this sad issue. Anyway, so that then given pretty much the history of EX with myself in perspective, in a sense. But I worked all I could and as much as I could within the limited freedom I had to do this, but with the foundation of the Alaska Native Language Center, then a huge part of my work was not only remained teaching on campus, but also running the center, especially fighting the administration to keep the center alive. And they never made it easy, you only made it hard. And so that ate up huge amounts of my time and effort, which could otherwise have been used more productively on something like EAC. And also the diminishing returns that during the 60s, while supported by NSF, I had managed to document relatively thoroughly, this language. Can we stop for a second while I...
Okay, we are back.
Yeah, I've always taken great care to do, say, two things. Make sure that everything is verified as much as possible, used of previous work, hence the preoccupation with the history of the study of EAC here on part. I never fancied I was the first person to work with the language, and I do, for posterity, wish it to be known that I don't think people should start suspecting if they see something in some previous work that they don't see in mine in the same form, that that means that I missed it or didn't pay any attention to it, quite the contrary. And so I, in a sense, both mean to have in the archives a as complete as possible collection of all previous documentation of EAC on the one hand, and at the same time to say that mine, I won't use the word supersedes all the rest, but takes into as much as possible full account of all previous work. That's one priority, and another is much more difficult to evaluate, is to, in documentation, to get down and in an explanatory way, as much as possible of what is left in living memory of the language in the field. And certainly worked with everyone that could be worked with. I mean, with everyone that there was, and they all were very cooperative, every single one. There's not a one of those six people who, given decent physical condition, did not work with me as well as they possibly could. And maybe I could give myself some credit for that, but I certainly mean to give them credit for understanding the stakes. And without exception, they were all very generous and cooperative and worked as well as they could. How much of what is left in their memories now, alone in Marie's, is a whole other question, but I feel what resurrected from oblivion has to be well into the 90-something percents of the lexicon that they remember, and pretty much likewise, at least to the best of my ability or sense, likewise grammar, although there's no end to either one. Surely some more could be done, but I dare say that I think that we have a pretty good, a very good documentation of what has been left of EAC in both in terms of accuracy and transcription, and B, in, or you know, observational adequacy, as it is said, and B, in terms of quantity. And I hope, or I dare say, sensibility of, you know, having investigated all possible or plausible areas of lexicon or of grammar, and so I've done insightfully, and I've been something of a bug about statistics in this regard too, and it would be adventure to say that we're coming pretty close to a record in the size of corpus, not sheer size, but percentage of what has been left in the living memory of a language down to its very last speakers and very last historic habitation and so on. Austerlitz helped a great deal with, incidentally, the key part of what he did was going carefully over as much as he could of the biota, the flora and fauna of the EAC area with the speakers, so that the number of plant names and medicinal uses and bird names and so on. He tried especially hard to work with, that was his main or his central theme in the limited work that he was able to do, which helped a certain amount, at least in the helped a lot in those areas. And so it's undoubtedly there's more, and there'll never be an end to any of it, but until the last speaker dies, in which case the corpus is closed. But the size of the corpus depends on how you count lexicon, but I would say it's probably 7,000 items or something like that in the present dictionary. Is which includes all the text and so on, is about as much as anybody's probably ever gotten from a language that is reduced to such a small scale. And I feel fairly, I'm sure that I will be cursed and ought to be for many shortcomings, even in the EAC work, but it's the best work I've done, and it is the I could be cursed or curse myself for a lot more had I not done it. And I also have to say this, that the documentation is especially fortunate in not only having all of the older work, which was productive, but also having the two personalities, especially of Lena Naktan, Saska Naktan, and Annie Nelson Harry, as the polar opposites and complementary to each other in terms of discipline versus creativity. Annie was extremely creative and imaginative and eloquent and fluent. She was the last person who could probably speak Eyak and enjoyed speaking Eyak more than any other language, and the only person with whom I ever got so that we conversed at all regularly in Eyak. It was very difficult for me to develop any fluency, given the fact that every one of those people spoke English, or Tlingit better than Eyak, or more readily than Eyak, except for Annie. And she loved to speak the language just for fun, and spoke to me as sort of to the ages and those stories. I could talk a lot more about those. But her creativity was the exact complement to Lena's great insistence and particularity about getting things right and accurate and so on. And I would often say, well, can, or she would often say, well, can you say this in Eyak? Harking to something that Annie had said or something, and she would say, well, Annie could, but I wouldn't. And Annie was, well, thank God, the analogy isn't quite complete, but would have been, could be called the James Joyce or something of Eyak. And that's, I would not say that, because I mean, certainly her texts are not to be looked like Finnegan's Wake. She is certainly the creative and imaginative, or not imaginative, creative speaker of the language and an artist with it. And Lena was absolutely inexhaustible patience and insistence on authenticity or correctness, and don't you put that down or put a question mark after that, because I'm not absolutely sure, and so on. And no such qualms would cross Annie's mind. And besides, it was much more difficult to work with her because she was quite deaf by the time I got to work with her, and you couldn't question her about, did you say this or did you say that? But you could check it over with Lena and you'd get an answer for sure. And she was extremely helpful in deciphering a lot of the texts. And she, I learned to do that from her accuracy, you know, over every syllable, be it a stutter, or, oh, that's just a stutter, or that's just part of a word. And she was going to say this, but changed her mind and said that, and so on. So this stuff is done very meticulously with Lena, including making sure that I was getting the right stuff and not any bogus or inaccurate stuff. And she had the patience of Job when it came to going through all the verbs and making sure, and all the nouns, see what noun class they belong to. Eyak is very rich in classification of nouns, and so you can get a given word, let's say medicine. If it's liquid medicine, it has to be treated one way in the grammar. If it's pills, it has to be treated another way, and so on. Or a dollar bill versus a quarter, because the nouns for 25 cents, given their shape, and a dollar, floppy dollar bill are very different things when you describe the nouns. Or how things can be displaced or moved depending on whether your egg is fresh or scrambled or hard boiled. This noun classification for the nouns, which is a cinch compared to the verbs, which are exquisitely complex, and would be happy, would patiently go over making sure I got everything just right. And she was very bright about it too. She would, in her mind, kept track of things in a way that she could even tell me, well, you ought to be able to figure that out because of these two forms, of, you know, which we before got, and so on. And I have to protest, well, maybe this one is irregular or something. But she's wonderful, insightful about the grammar and so on. And Annie was the creative one. So working between the two of them, literally between, going back and forth between Cordova and Yakutat, and working between the two of them, I was a perfect privilege to get a perspective on Iyak that nothing, I've never had the like of those two extremes with any other language in my career. So the Iyak corpus is very fortunate, especially because of the contrast between those two personalities. And so I would say a fairly well-rounded picture of Iyak, with the probable exception of casual conversation, which was not to be readily had except under artificial conditions, including with Anna, with Annie and me, not only because of my limited ability, but also because of her limited hearing, you couldn't just chat and so on. So it was not possible to reconstruct, you know, family life or something, conversation in Iyak. Although I did try, you know, for getting baby terms and all kinds of colloquial things. We have to be aware that we're lucky we got what we did, and it's relatively well documented in terms of the dictionary or the materials for the dictionary, and in terms of text, there's pathetically little in a way, almost all of it from Annie, but thank God it's from Annie. And it's probably only about 7-8 hours of tape altogether. And when it comes to elicitations, probably, I don't know, 25,000-30,000. Elicitations designed maximally to cover the language. So anyway, you know, I often like to compare that with, let's say, the kind of documentation we have of Hebrew. And although it's the corpus of text is only about the extent of the Book of Genesis or something, which is a small part of the classical Hebrew corpus, would that we had half a decent, number one, a documentation for Hebrew of the way it was pronounced and the way the phonology worked, A, and B, the grammar, and C, I don't know how many different birds are mentioned in the Bible or how many different plants, but probably half of them aren't identified at all. Mm-hmm. We can't even guess what they were. We may or may not have the word for earlobe or pupil of eye or knob on wrist or something, from classical Hebrew merely by chance, would we? Because there was never any systematic lexical coverage of classical Hebrew. Just what happens to get mentioned in the Bible. And with EAC, we've got far better record of the language in that sense.
Right, let me change tape here.
Which was enough, by the way, to be the basis of a revival of the language.